Calling all benders and non-benders alike. Jump into the epic world of Avatar with your favorite podcast, Avatar Braving the Elements. Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Each week we'll recap and discuss a new episode.
So come join us and our amazing guests, from creators to cast to superfans, to chat about all things Avatarverse.
It's Fire Nation time. Book of Fire. Let's go. Listen to Avatar Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we are coming to you live from a couple of places on the internet. We are live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, X or Twitter or whatever they're calling it these days. Twitter. Yes, we're calling it.
We're going to Twitter.
And maybe you're listening later. Spotify, Android, Apple.
I like that you're always trying to guess with people. You're never going to get a yes. You're not going to get like, you nailed it.
Yeah. Thank you, Alex, for identifying my platform. No, it's not going to happen. Anyway, wherever you are listening, we really appreciate it. We have a great show for you. Pete is off today, but Justin and I are here to usher you through the world of comic books.
That's what we do. We're ushers, and we want to welcome you through. Please sit down. Don't put your feet up.
Don't use your phone unless you're watching on your phone, in which case, please use your phones.
Please use your phone.
Exactly. Confusing. Confusing if people are like, whoop. Phone down, phone up, phone down.
Inevitable.
Inevitable. You know what else is inevitable? Our guest this evening, who we are very excited to bring in, he, among many, many other things, is the creator of the new upcoming book, Where the Body Was. Ladies and gentlemen, Ed Brubaker. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh, so excited to have you here. I should have asked you this before we went on, but I wanted to clarify something first. When does this book come out?
Oh, the book comes out in mid-December in comic stores and early January in bookstores.
Okay, all right. I was seeing multiple dates, so I guess it's...
Yeah, no, it's because we switched from Diamond, so we have two different distributors now, so we didn't want to be the very last book distributed by Diamond, so we pushed it into technical.
Yeah. Yeah. So nice, though. The book could have, like, walked out, took one last look back, shut off the light.
Yeah.
The Diamond line.
Yeah, no, it was just you know, because Image moved to Simon and Schuster for book market, and we wanted to go that route with this one because it's such a aimed at the book market kind of book in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, I mean, all our stuff kind of is aimed at both markets, really.
Well, for sure, and I definitely want to talk about that, but let's just set up where the body was is first. I mean, we read this book. We won't get into any spoilers. You don't want us to, but I thought it was absolutely phenomenal. And also a very different book for you and Sean Phillips, even though it seems like it's framed as a crime book. It's not I wouldn't necessarily characterize it exactly as a crime book. What would you call it?
I mean, there's crime in it. I just, I feel like, if you put the story in a different order, probably it would just, you could put it in the order of a crime book, but the way the story is told from all the different points of view, it almost seems more like a true crime podcast or something, a collection of short stories, or like a Tom Perata book or something, where it's like every narrator tells you their part and you're like, oh, wait. I always wanted to do something like that. And I just thought it'd be really cool to do something like that was also a crime story. And then as I was writing it, like, the characters just take over so much, because they each have their own, stories to tell and desires and fucked up thoughts.
And you get a lot of real connection, exposure, intimacy with the characters, I feel like. There's some sort of direct-to-panel talking that happens that I found sort of like, oh, God, you're looking right at me. Like,
yeah. Fourth wall breaking. Yeah, that's like one of the things I really wanted to do with this book was do things you could only do in comics in a lot of ways. I mean, people do that in movies, like someone will just, like Fleabag or something, they'll turn and talk to the screen, or, lots of movies have done that over time. But I just always thought of it as a comic book thing. Like, as a kid reading like Charlie Brown, he's like walking down the street, just sort of talking to you and explaining his thoughts. And When I first broke into comics, I did these sort of loosely autobiographical comics, this series Low Life, and it was heavily influenced by Harvey Pekar, the guy that did American Splendor. And I remember the first time I read American Splendor, it was like all drawn by Robert Crumb. And it was just this kind of grungy looking guy standing there and talking right at you with these giant word balloons. And I'd never done anything like that in any of me and Sean's stuff. So I just thought, okay, let's do weird things. Let's break the fourth wall. Let's, you know, let's have people age between scenes. Let's, you know, let's really do things that comics can do that that no other medium can really get away with as well.
I do want to get back to this in a second, but before I forget, I should probably mention that every week on the show, we have a professional chef, and this is true down in New Orleans, named Brett Macris, called Straight Bullet, who's on the stream right now, and he either curates or designs a cocktail for us, and this week he did one inspired by the book called Where the Bourbon Was.
That's great.
It's a mix of bourbon chair liqueur with a cinnamon whipped cream floater, and you drop some like cinnamon through flame to light it up. It's pretty delicious.
That's awesome.
Weird whipped cream mustache this entire show, but there you go. But back to the book. Wait for the cocktail, unless you wanted to say more about the cocktail, Justin.
I love it. It's perfect for the holidays. Sit by the fire, read this book, and sip some bourbon. You'll find where the bourbon is very quickly.
Yeah, the body takes a while to get to.
Exactly. There's no mystery here.
Yeah.
So you were mentioning, though, this is a very different mode for you and Sean Phillips. What was his reaction when you brought this to him? What were the challenges for him, if anything, not to make you talk about what's going on with him artistically?
Well, I just sort of had this bolt of inspiration when he was, we were almost done with Night Fever, and I was trying to figure out what to do next. And I was kind of stuck on, it's weird. I have like kind of a rough idea of what to do for the 7th Reckless book, but I'm still stuck figuring out the 6th one. Which is like a series book problem. But so I was like, maybe we should just do another new thing. And then suddenly I was moving some books around in my office, and I was looking at some of those old paperback map back covers. And I thought, you know, I always wanted to do something like that, where it was like all on a location, like all the different characters were in the sort of same location. You could have a map. And then I just started thinking about like, oh, well, what would that be? And I had like 3 different stories that I had sort of started notebooking at different points to be like a full book. And I didn't feel like, you know, like they just never stuck really. And then suddenly I was like, well, who would be the people in these houses? And I started seeing the connections. I was like, oh, wow, okay, that could all be happening at the same time. And they're like, sort of rippling off of each other and causing these things to happen and these complications. And then I just like grabbed a notebook. I usually have like a bunch of spare notebooks from this company.
Yeah.
Bridge. I just like the feel of their paper, and their notebooks are pretty big. And I just grabbed the notebook, and I spent like 3 days just sort of trying to sort of make a loose map of the street and who all the people were and what their lives were. And I filled up pretty much a whole notebook with the outline and like all the different stuff. And then writing it was really sort of more about figuring out what chapters to put in what order kind of, but yeah, it was just a real big burst of inspiration. And then I just sort of told Sean and sent him like, I'd made my wife do like a sketch of the street to try to give him an idea of like how to do the map. And then he was really into it. I mean, he always likes to try to do something different. And for that, because we had designed the street first, he like actually found someone, one of his Instagram followers or something who makes 3D, like an architect or somebody who made like a whole 3D model based on that. And then Sean sort of, you know, redid it. But like, so Sean could use that when he was penciling the book. So all the houses are exactly where they're supposed to be, and look at, you know, all the shrubbery awesome. And stuff was not in it, obviously, because those programs don't do so good with that. But yeah, so it was like, it was really interesting. And it's funny, I talked to someone else, and I can't remember what the book is, but one of the Scotty Young books, like the artist hired someone to actually design like this entire 3D model of like a Victorian house so that they could use it. And it really saves time on drawing backgrounds in the pencils, at least.
Yeah, right.
Now,
you said you filled up a whole notebook. So does that mean, going from that, are you editing there? Are you like,
I had probably another 100 pages of stuff that I could have jammed into that story somehow, like different other characters that didn't end up having storylines. And it's kind of always how it is. Like you write a bunch of stuff, and then the story that ends up is like the stuff that you actually need to make the story work. So it's always better to know too much than too little.
Are you ever cutting stuff that Sean's already drawn? And it's like,
it's really rare. I mean, it's because of the way comics teaches you, especially if you come out of like monthly comics, like you're used to sort of writing it a chapter at a time and getting it right and then moving forward. And it's like the one thing that I do when we finish our books, like I usually have a pretty good outline of the book ahead of time. And then I send it to Sean a chapter or two at a time. And, you know, so he's drawing it while I'm still writing it, but I know where it's going. But the one thing that I do when it's all done and Sean has it all lettered and he'll send me a PDF of all the inked lettered pages while Jake's coloring it. And I'll go over it and I'll usually make a bunch of little minor changes, or like sometimes like some caption feels like, oh, we don't really need that caption there, which is, you know, drive Sean crazy because then he has to draw it, like take it out and draw it back. Because he letters right on the page, so he has to like draw a background on the digital file. And but like stuff like that, like I'll edit stuff, or sometimes like some line of dialogue just feels really cheesy after I see the whole book done, and I'm like, all right, and I'll rewrite stuff. But it gives me like one chance to polish it all when I have the whole book. I have like a month where I just kind of read it every day and sort of send Sean, you know, too many notes about minor little changes to do.
I just wanted to mention real briefly, I think the Scotty Young book you're talking about is The Me You Love in the Dark.
Oh yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great book.
Great book. You
check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To ask you like a little further about coming at this almost character first, which I find really fascinating. Do you think of real people as reference, or do these people emerge whole cloth out of your imagination as you flesh them out on the page?
Well, I mean, there's different theories about that. Like some writers will tell you every character is some part of yourself. And I think that's true to a large degree, but yeah, I mean, there's pieces of me in all the different characters, but they're also sort of inspired by different people too. Like the young guy and girl in the book are sort of, you know, loosely inspired by me and like a girl that I knew in the summer of 84. And like the therapist and his wife are based on, you know, loosely inspired by like a guy that shared an office with my uncle who may or may not have tried to kill his wife. So stuff like that.
I feel like I know the answer to that.
Yeah. But you know, I don't want to spoil the book for anybody, but it's, you know, I always start from character and then the plot sort of comes out of that. Like I'll have an idea for, you know, a character in a situation, but I don't, you know, like I think plot is sort of like the spine that what you really want goes around. Like I'm not a very high concept writer, you know, like if my high concept is all these people live on the same street.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the high concept as our lives in the suburbs.
Yeah. But I mean, but that's the kind of books that we've always done, you know, in a way. It's like every now and then they sound commercial or something, but really they're just stories about people making mistakes, falling in love, being heartbroken.
Well, and like
murdering people,
a murder here or there between the neighborhood.
There's a lot of murder. There's a lot of sex in this one.
Mm-hmm. Don't I know it? Reading it on the subway in Brooklyn.
There's fairly graphic sex in it. Oh, you were reading it on the subway? Wow. Okay.
I was rereading it today on the subway, and I was like, oh right, I could have to scan quickly through a lot of this. Family of seven, right over hovering over my shoulder.
I showed some of the pages to my friend Chip Zdarsky, and then I showed him the cover, and he's like, this is the most nudity you've ever had in a book, and there's like a dead guy on the cover. Like, don't let anyone know.
Hilarious. He's like, flip that. That's
One of the things that I was really impressed about with the book was the pacing of it in terms of how it lays out answers about our characters. I'm not going to mention anything specific again. It's coming out in a while, but at this point, you've done so many of those. Is that an instinctual thing to know, okay, by about page 25 or so, the reader is going to be really wondering about this thing. I got to start answering this thing there.
Yeah, it's probably instinct at this point. I think also, like, you're always trying to keep yourself entertained and make sure that you're doling out, you know, whatever information that you need to know about the different characters at the right pace. I think at this point, just because I've written so much stuff, that what I really try to do now is just make sure everybody can understand characters and then try to do things that people weren't expecting to happen, you know, but that also feel like, oh yeah, that's what would happen. You know, it's like there's always like, with any story, you want it to feel both familiar and surprising at the same time, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I think a lot of it is just with so many different characters in a story, it was kind of important more than anything to know whose parts of the story would go first. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was really the timeline part of it was a lot to wrap my head around. Like, I looked back at the map a lot when I was working. I just had it like tacked up on the wall next to my desk so I could see where everybody was supposed to be and when.
That's awesome. But
yeah, like, you don't even meet the private eye until you're almost halfway through the book.
There were various times reading the book when I was like, wait, you don't think that guy is, and then I'd flip the page and be like, oh, he is. Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah.
It was very nicely paced out that way.
Yeah, that's why it's really important not to see who the head of the guy on the cover. Yeah. You can't really, because then the book feels so much more tense if you're reading it and you're like, wait, is that guy going to be the guy who gets killed? Or who gets killed?
And it's something that I think our brains are programmed now to, we always have that tickling in so much of the things we watch and read. Like, who's going to die here? I know someone does.
It's, yeah, there's this thing. I wonder if it's to do with that, you know, we, so much of the way we watch shows with like marathoning and stuff is like, you're watching it and you're like, well, I just want to get to the answer, you know? And this sense of, right. I remember when I first started reading mystery books, I worked at a used bookstore and I would just pick up some trash mystery when I was like bored and no one's coming in and I was working till midnight or something. I'd be like, all right, I'll start reading this. And if I don't finish it by the end of the shift, I'll flip to the end and find out who did it. And I feel like a lot of people like watch TV or movies that way now, where they just are like fast forwarding through parts that seem like, I don't really care about this character. And that sense of like always trying to figure things out or guess, I feel like is something you can really utilize as a writer with your readers. Cause if you can,
that point, then do you think, and I'm really trying to skirt spoilers here, but do you think there's a certain sense of like working against that with this book? Because again, reading it while I was trying to figure out mysteries about the characters, you live in this world so much with these people and you learn to care about them by the end, the mystery is almost secondary in a certain
way. Yeah.
Was this something you were working against, that sort of a figure it out brain?
Well, I knew people when reading the book would be waiting for someone to be dead on the street because it's right there on the map. Mm-hmm. A really funny thing was, for a long time while we were working on the book, I couldn't come up with a name for it, even though we'd made the early version of the map that had the little legend. And it wasn't until one day I was just looking at the map and I just read the legend again. And I got to the bottom where it said where the body was. And I was like, oh, that's a great name for the book. Because I kept trying to come up with something that felt like really evocative of both a mystery thing or like a crime story, but also that felt evocative of the span of time of your life, kind of like, because for me the book is really about just sort of people and how people change as they at different ages, kind of like all the different characters are sort of struggling with like love and desire and desperation, and they're all at different places in their life, so they're all dealing with it completely differently. Like, you know, the unhappy, yeah, they, the unhappy a wife who, you know, is lives next door to the, you know, the sort of chip on his shoulder, you know, cop.
Yeah. There's a, that makes me want to talk about that, but I won't. The way the book is sort of like nostalgia. I feel like you have nostalgia and you're in the back matter, which is so nice to read.
Yeah.
Right after it. It's, you don't add a ton of detail, but you feel your emotion come through there in such a way, and you can tell you're nostalgic for it. But rereading it today, I was like, the characters are anti-nostalgia. They're like, they're so out on it. And I'm so curious how that switch flipped so hard for a story that it feels like you have a lot of looking back on your life.
Well, I'm old enough now that when I look back at my teen years or my youth, I, like, you know, like we all have those moments where you're like, you just suddenly remember that thing, that stupid thing you said that one time, or that time you got way too drunk that you still regret, you know, like we all have those. And, but now I feel like I'm old enough that I give myself a lot more slack, because, you know, like I realize like, okay, well, all that stuff had to happen for me to be where I am in life anyway. And so I feel like I give myself a lot more slack. So I'm sort of nostalgic for times and people sometimes, but like I feel like everything sort of went the way it was supposed to go. So when I was writing all the different characters, I just kind of thought, I don't know, it's something about being able to write a wider cast of characters. You can sort of be more brutal about being able to get inside their heads, you know. When you're writing just like a single character, there's a certain assumption that you're writing about yourself, even when you aren't. But when you're writing about a lot more people, you can actually like let them sort of let their shit hang out a little bit more and show their sort of the things that they're scared of about themselves, you know, or the things that they're desperate or lonely, or, you know, everyone's desperate and lonely on some level, you know. And I think sometimes when you're writing like a superhero story or a crime story or something, you can forget to put that part in. And it's like, well, that's where the crime comes from, is the desperation and the loneliness.
Yeah. But, it's so interesting to hear you talk about this, just because my assumption would be focusing on one character, you get to drive it on them even more because you spend more time with them, but it doesn't seem to be that way for you.
I mean, it really depends on what, on the story you're telling. Like when you want to write something that, that sort of grapples more with like this started out as a crime story, but he, as I was outlining it, I realized like, oh, this is the romance comic that Sean wanted me to write like 5 years ago when I wrote My Heroes Have Always Been Junkies, which is very much not a romance comic. This one is much more like a romance comic in a way, and also nostalgic, and also has crime, and, you know, it just feels like it runs sort of the gamut of human existence. Mm-hmm. And so doing a thing like that, I really felt the need to have a bunch of different main characters who, because everyone's, you know, we all experience similar things, but we also feel differently about, you know, life and the things that happen to us in it. And, you know, Everyone understands jealousy and resentment, but also, you know, not everyone understands, you know, a deep love or passion. You know, it's like we all experience it all differently, but we're all sort of coming at the same stuff. And so for me, it just seemed like, you know, let's make it a big sprawling mess, like life feels most of the time.
Well, and also with a larger cast, they sort of have to say their deep truth quickly.
You do get a lot of story. It's funny, I was thinking when I was telling my wife about it while I was working on it, she said, oh, kind of like that movie Shortcuts, and I was like, oh yeah. I remember I was like, oh yeah, there's like a serial killer in that movie, actually.
That's right.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's Chris Penn.
Mm-hmm. It's like spoilers.
Spoilers for a 40-year-old movie.
I did want to ask you, and this is a bit of a broader question, but since you brought up the romance comment of it all, I was very glad to hear you say that and glad to hear you touch on that, because reading the book, I was like, wait, is this a romance comic? And then validation, it is.
Yeah.
But there seems to be a retaking of romance comics really in the past year or so in comics through this, through Tom King, I know, is riffing on it in Love Everlasting. There's also She-Hulk over in Marvel, which is pretty much straight up a romance comic as well. Why do you think that's coming back now?
Oh, probably because just like when romance comics became a big deal the first time was when superheroes were dying in the in the market. Like, I feel like comics are in this really interesting place where, like, I mean, depending on who you listen to, like, you know, the superhero stuff isn't doing as well as it was, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago anymore. And I feel like comics had this interesting thing happen in like the 60s and 70s, where they were the first publishing industry where the fans kind of took over. And so comics has always artificially kept superheroes going until there's like another boom. And then, you know, they never just are like, superheroes aren't selling anymore. And then they go back to only doing like 5 or 10 of them like they did in the 50s. You know, there was a period of time where the only superhero comics that came out were like Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Captain Marvel, maybe the Shazam Captain Marvel. Like, for years, those were the only superhero comics that came out. And they all sold like a million copies, but nobody cared about any other. And but so I wonder if to some degree comics are hitting that point again where it's time to start throwing different shit at the wall and see what sticks, you know, because that's how crime comics and horror comics and romance comics ended up being. The, you know, the publishers back then were just businessmen. They didn't care about the art form at all. They were just like, hey, these aren't selling. What's selling? Make more of that. You know, so I suspect creatively, romance comics are just a really funny and interesting kind of part of the history of comics, because like romance comics were created by the same people that created Captain America. Like Kirby, Simon and Kirby did the first one, you know. So it's kind of weird. And John Romita, who's like everyone's favorite Spider-Man artist, was like the best like romance comic artist ever. So for me, it was just, you know, they were like the comics you'd get teased by if your friends saw them in your pile when I was a little kid. You know, like I would hide my, but I would buy them for the John Romita covers usually. And, you know, I'm pretty sure like my first crush in life was like a drawing by John Romita.
Like
Mickey Gwen Stacy.
I mean, just to keep this broad for a second, just because this has been so much of the zeitgeist, is the whole "are comics dying" discussion is cropping up once again, big time. I know Tom Brevoort likes to joke comics dying since 1935 because it crops up every 20 years or so. But you're in a very specific place where you revolutionized a lot of stories in superhero comic books, and then have mostly not struck out on your own, but with Sean Phillips, with other creators, and have built a cottage industry behind you with books like this, with Crow, et cetera. So what's your take on that? Are comics dying now, or are they just perennially dying?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask, because our stuff is basically, you know, I mean, our readership is really steady and growing. You know, I'm working on like TV show and movie adaptations of our books, which will hopefully bring our work to even bigger audiences. But also, we've spent 20 years, you know, building a body of work and a relationship with comic book store retailers, so that like they know when, like when we're putting out a new graphic novel, they generally know how many they can sell, like, you know, ballpark at least. So like we get orders for our graphic novels that are like the first issue of a comic, you know, so they're not like just ordering enough to get through a week at a time like they would on a lot of other graphic novels. So we're really in an incredibly lucky spot, you know, but we've also like spent 20 years doing like 2 books a year for, and, you know, a lot of outreach to retailers to sort of get them on board. And so we have a really loyal following among both retailers and comic readers. And, you know, and beyond that, like, you know, Book Market is, you know, probably 40% of our sales at this point. So we still do most of our audiences in comic stores.
It feels to me like from a fan perspective that the as super stories get super complex everyone is like, I don't know what's happening. And that's why romance comics, stuff like that, then pops, like horror.
Yeah.
Comics, simple storytelling.
Yeah. I mean, it's frustrating having been there. It's like, my ideas of what comic Marvel or DC should do to try to revitalize things are the kind of things that might like not work for them because they've built a giant machine and the machine needs to keep running. Like I always thought the Marvel bankruptcy was like the best thing that ever happened to Marvel because they could kind of start over small and build. And then, but now everything's so big, like both of these companies publish like 50 to 75 books a month or something. And it's less, and there's crossover. When I first started at Marvel, we did one crossover a year. And even that was like, you didn't have to participate if you didn't want to. Like I did one issue for a Captain America thing. And I barely did anything with Civil War because I knew coming out of it, I was doing the death of Cap. So like, but what really feels like just from an outsider perspective, because this is not, you know, I don't buy a lot of these books anymore. I follow stuff my friends do, but I'm so far behind on most of that stuff. But it feels like there used to always be like 5 or 6 books from each company that everybody was like just loved and was kind of obsessed with. And it doesn't feel like they have that anymore. They might each have 1 or 2, but I think those 5 or 6 books really sort of keep other people buying the other books in the line. But now they're all so expensive and the paper is so shitty that they're printed on. And it's just like, I don't know how, like my gut tells me they need to go back to using that like nice newsprint that like Jake and his friend used on their new book. And just really starting to care about the product itself. And you know, the only thing that sells comics is good comics. Like, some shitty comics sell really well. You know, but even
short term,
when DC was putting out like the Watchmen movie or the V for Vendetta movie, like they sold like 1 million copies of each of those books, like before the movie, the month before the movie came out, because those are really good books. Like there, you can give them to anybody and I'll be able to understand it. We've gotten to this point with superhero comics right now where it just feels like they're nonstop event machines. And if you don't want to have to buy a bunch of books that you don't follow, then you're going to feel lost a lot of the time. Like I'm actually the worst person to ask about this stuff. Cause I would never, if I ran Marvel, they would never do a crossover event. They would publish like 20 books a month that were all really good books. My idea is make more with less. Like why not 20 comics that each sell 100,000 copies instead of 70 comics and 2 of them sell 100,000 and, you know, 68 of them sell 20,000, you know, most of which are just different covers. Like it's just that whole thing of chasing all the different covers and all of that just doesn't compute to me at all. I was never a collector, so I don't understand that side of the market, but I think catering to it too much, you hear about these stores that bought 500 copies of a book so they could get some cover, and then that store goes out of business and it's like, great, let's just start decimating the market. So
well, from maybe they all have a crush. They all have a crush on a different Gwen Stacy on the cover.
Yeah. But I feel like a market needs to be really nurtured. And the direct market is one of the greatest, you know, direct market saved comics. And, you know, I feel like these companies need to nurture that market and understand what a great thing it actually is for them instead of sort of trying to bleed it dry, which is what I feel like we're in that phase where, but I feel like that about almost every company in the world, even outside of comics. Like try to read an article on your phone now while you're like waiting in line for something and it's just nonstop pop-up ads. And remember when iPhones, like up until 2 or 3 years ago, you never saw an ad on your iPhone for anything. But now it's like, we're the product, everything. It's Corey, what's the guy from Boing Boing?
Doctorow.
Yeah, Corey Doctorow said, he refers to it as shitification. And it's we're in that phase. And it's like comics needs to avoid that somehow. And the way to do that is just good comics that surprise people, that are fun, or that are worth the money, you know, like products, like good books that are like hardback books, like that new Klaus book, like the paper is like my God, you could take pieces of the paper out and murder people with it. It's and like our books,
the plot of your next graphic novel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But like our books, we print. Now we print in China because printing prices went up so much in like America and Canada. But like we print on really good paper with like, you know, we put out a really good product. I want like a book that looks good on someone's shelf that they actually care about. And, you know, I guess I'm incredibly lucky that we ended up in a place, you know, at Image and me and Sean just doing our own thing forever. And just, we just sort of keep our heads down and make our books. But we also made a deal where we always got to choose the paper. We always got to design the book ourselves. Like the product itself is really important to us. And, you know, like I just wish that Marvel and DC would take more pride in that part of it. You know, like DC does to some degree. Like they have Black Label, which those books look really good and are oversized. Okay, yeah. And, you know, so DC still has that connection to the sort of art side of it. Like, you know, they don't have Vertigo anymore, but they still, you know, they still understand that you can make these kind of evergreen, weird, upscale products and do well with them.
It but is funny to be like, to have a separate imprint. It's like DC, the good ones.
Yeah.
Good ones. You're going to want to hold on.
Well, it's like I always thought like Vertigo was for people who were tired of reading superhero comics or something, but they didn't want to stop reading monthly color comics because back then, like all the alternative comics were like black and white, you know, so they still wanted to read something that sort of was in the same realm. They wanted adventure stories or mystery stories. They didn't just want, you know, stories about me like walking down the street being depressed, you know, or, you know, stuff like that. But I think, yeah, I don't know. I've been following some of this discussion about like how the industry is doing, you know, and I wish I had an answer. I think, you know, like Brevoort, I think probably comics will come out the other side of this, and I know from people I know who are working at Marvel and DC that there are a lot of big plans for next year for both of these companies that I think will be things people get really excited about. But yeah, it's something that we all talk about from time to time. And, you know, I don't know, it's hard for me not to really think that some of these companies, I don't want to point fingers too much, but some of these companies have really kind of abused the market instead of nurturing it. And then they try to stand there and be like, well, you know, times are tough. And it's like, well, you know, times aren't tough. You made them tough.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
There's this whole thing of like I get a little, when I hear people at these companies say stuff like that, it's just kind of like, well, no, you had a great thing. And then you couldn't just be okay with it at the level that it was at. Everyone always has to try to push for more. I remember when Marvel raised the prices from $3 to $4 and just overnight, like Disney bought them. And then the next day they raised the prices because they wanted to have a really big first quarter at Disney. And we would go to comic conventions and just hear nonstop complaints from our fans that they had to spend $4 on a comic all of a sudden. And we'd go back to them and tell them that stuff. And they're like, we won't lose as many sales as we make the extra money. And it was like, well, we did, actually. Yeah. Like, we went down more than 25% in sales because people were like, yeah, I don't want to spend $4 on a single issue that's 20 pages. So, yeah,
But that gets into what you were talking about earlier with the pop-up ads and Cory Doctorow. I mean, I work during the daytime at Digital Media, and without calling up my company or any other companies, it's this game where it's like, oh, we put up some ads, less people are looking at it because the web pages look like crap. Now, how are we going to make that money up? More ads. And I think it's the same thing that you're saying.
Yeah, it's this endless cycle. I feel like we're all trapped in this endless cycle. I cannot wait for Twitter to just finally actually die. Like, I just wonder what will happen to the landscape of the internet without, like, that sort of one social media space that, you know, is such a shitty place, but that had this brief moment of feeling like this really kind of important, interesting place. And then
square.
Yeah, the supposed town square. But I mean, it was best before it was the town square, when it was just a bunch of people just sort of talking about stuff they liked and making dumb jokes and, you know, But then it became just people screaming at each other at some point. And, you know, I feel like I stayed years too long at that point of just where you'd log in and immediately just your blood pressure would start going up just based on, you know, things people were saying.
And,
just,
and like, it shouts for our users on Twitter. Yeah,
I don't know. You know, I feel like there are friends that I met on there, you know, that I'm still friends with, and I'm really happy for like the good things that came out of Twitter. But I definitely think the bad of it outweighed the good in the long run. And, you know, like I made a joke the other day, I'm like, I don't want to argue in favor of gatekeepers, but you know, it would have been nice for someone to keep all the totally insane people in the internet from finding each other immediately. or partition them off. It's like, oh, okay. Like that used to be harder in the days of the zines.
We got a couple of, sorry to interrupt. Do have a couple of questions and comments from YouTube that I wanted to bring up before we run out here. Oh, this is from Liam. One of my favorite creators and some of my favorite YouTubers on one video. I'm saving this and watching you guys at work. Please tell Ed I love his Reckless and Criminal series and Kill or Be Killed.
Nice.
This is from Nat. Ed, this is about Where the Body Was. Would you ever turn this into an audio drama or write an original audio drama?
I don't think I would turn this into an audio drama, although I don't know, actually. I guess, I don't know. Audible, call me. I'd be more interested in it being an audio book than selling it on Kindle as a graphic novel. I'm really on the verge of just stopping digital releases of our books until the paperbacks are out, just because I'm just so annoyed at the digital versions of things. Like Comixology at least was readable, but I feel like, I don't know, there's something now about the digital stuff that when we put out the last book, like the day of release, like halfway through the day, Amazon took our book was $25 and Amazon priced the Kindle at $9.99 for some reason for like a day, and you're like, wait, what? You're undercutting our price. So that really annoyed me. But yeah, I don't know. I'm too busy to write an original audio drama, but I like stuff like that. A friend of mine took a book she had started writing and turned it into one, and it came out really good. So maybe.
This is from Kevin. Speaking of bookshelves, what's on Ed's?
A lot of books. Lots of stuff. A lot of books. I have the Fargo collection for the TV show, some screenplays, a book about Gary Shandling,
a
collection of Joan Didion essays, just way too much stuff. All the Dashiell Hammett Continental Ops stories. This is not all my books. This is just the ones I've got on this shelf in this room.
when you get the horizontals on top of the verticals, you know.
Yeah, I'm in the process of sort of going through. I'm in the do I want to give this to someone or read it again phase of my life, right, where I'm trying to. I live in a kind of a small house for part of the year, and I want to have all the books that I want with me all the time. So I'm trying to consolidate my bookshelves a little bit, which is painful as a lifelong book collector.
How do you throw those books away?
I used to donate stuff to the library, and then I found out they don't put them on the shelves. They sell them at library sales. And I'm like, wait,
really?
Wow. Yeah. So I just donate books to like really good used bookstores now. Like there's one in LA, the Iliad bookstore. That's like one of the best used bookstores ever. And there's one, near where I live that is still in operation, where I every now and then I go in and find some really weird old paperback book that I was looking for in the mid-80s. I'm like, yes, used bookstores. I'm really nostalgic for that. I'm trying to sort of go back to as much of an analog life as I can for someone who spends a good portion of their day in front of a computer. So like, that's the great thing about being a comic reader, though, is like I definitely have read a lot of comics on my computer or on an iPad, but the comics that I really lose myself in are like the, you know, big, like right now I'm really digging the Watership Down graphic novel that just got released a couple weeks ago. And that is like, it's like a 500 page adaptation of a 500 page book.
spoil it. It gets very sad at the end. Just
because. Yeah. I saw the movie as a child, but my dad told me like right before the movie started, oh, by the way, this is not a kid's movie. So to me, I always thought it was one of the greatest movies. My wife was taken to it. She's a few years younger than me, and she went to see it in the theater too. And her mom thought it was a kid's movie. So she thinks it's the scariest movie that's ever been made.
I remember being traumatized by that movie as a kid.
It's cute bunnies living. I was like, of course, I read the book. Yeah. I had the book read to me first. And I was like, every day, I was like, wow, how can this
happen? It's Lord of the Rings with bunnies, basically.
100%.
It's like so horrifying to see rabbits killing each other. But, but you know, that's like an experience where you have to sit there with a hardback book and you really kind of lose yourself in it. Mm-hmm. And it's so, I find like I can't even have my phone near me when I'm reading anymore because like your phone buzzes and you look at it and you're like, I used to have concentration. Like what happened? So it's like the only time I have concentration now is when I block everything out so that I can get writing done. And then it's like an enormous amount of input after that. So it's like I'm reading and have the TV on and I'm listening to music. Like, what the hell is going on here?
I want to ask you sort of about the opposite experience, whatever you can comment on, and maybe you won't be able to comment on, but I was curious about updates on a couple of projects. Batman Caped Crusader, I believe you were announced as head writer of that last year. Are you still on that at this point now that it's at Amazon?
I wrapped on that before they even announced, I think. I think they announced me while we were still working on it, but I was done on that about a year and a half ago, probably. I'm still like the actual writing of it. Like there was some post writing stuff, but yeah, I'm seeing like early cuts of episodes now, for most of that stuff, but I wasn't able to go back for season two because, partly the strike, but also working on a movie and a TV show at Amazon.
Mm. Well, I think that gets it to the next thing I wanted to ask you about. Criminal is maybe at Amazon. Maybe you're doing that as a TV show.
We are working on it as a TV show. There should be some announcements coming out about progress on that in the next, hopefully this week, maybe next week. I don't know. But it's all looking really positive right now. So fingers crossed.
And is that both you and Sean are involved in it, or is it just you and Sean consulting?
Well, I'm like the showrunner. I have a co-showrunner, this guy Jordan Harper, who is an amazing crime writer. He actually his novel just got listed as like in the top like 10 crime novels of the year in the New York Times yesterday. He did this book Everybody Knows. And Jordan, I read his books, and when this show got set up, my exec, Matt King at Amazon, like the first thing I said was, well, can I get Jordan Harper? Like, because he was already talking to him about something else. And so he sort of took him off of another project and gave him to me to be my co-showrunner. Awesome. So and we put together a team last December, January. And so we did we still have a few weeks left in the writing room for the first season, but we're essentially like almost done writing the whole first season of the show. So, you know, assuming all things keep going the direction they are, you know, but it's Hollywood. So, you know, I've been close a few times. This feels more real than it's ever felt before. But, you know, until I see announcements in trades or really until I see it nowadays, until you see it actually airing, though Amazon
doesn't seem to be.
Yeah, I mean, I did work on the Batman show, which, you know, up until the day that they canceled the show off of Max, they were telling us it was going to be on HBO Max. And there was 100% no chance that we were not going to get, you know, and then one day they called us up and they were like, so David Zaslav canceled the show, but we're not going to stop production. We're just going to sell it somewhere else. And then we sold it to Amazon like a week later.
Yeah.
So,
Amazon seems, I mean, this is just from talking to folks about it, very supportive of comic book writers, almost conversely to what they're doing with Comixology right now. But like between what you're saying with Criminal, we talked to Scott Snyder about his stuff on witches, everything.
I mean, there's a lot. I think it's the executives that have ended up there are just people who are really receptive to the material. Like I was on a deal at Legendary before I was on my deal at Amazon, and the same guys that I, you know, the same three people that I was working with at Legendary basically moved over to Amazon and kind of took over Amazon. Yeah, it was like the first, it was the only time a reshuffle at a company has ever come out in my favor, actually. So I was just like, okay, I've been trying to do this for, you know, I've been going to LA and working on film and TV since the, you know, mid 2000s or early 2000s. And so, you know, I've worked on a lot of stuff that's gotten made at this point, but yeah, this is really like the dream has always been not just to work on things that get made. A lot of that stuff, like Westworld or Batman, like a lot of that was for the experience of doing it. Like the Batman thing was really like you guys, I imagine. I'm like one of the hugest fans of BTAZ, and like there's two specific episodes of that I think are like the best Batman things ever. Like, and there was
Which episodes? What are they? You got to say.
Oh, okay. There's the one where the Scarecrow episode where Batgirl gets thrown off the roof and dies.
Oh, of course, terrifying. Terrifying as a kid.
Yeah.
Just like.
I mean, I saw that when I was in my 20s, and I was like, "Oh, this is one of the greatest Batman stories ever." And then there's the first one I ever saw was like another Scarecrow one, I think, where like it was maybe first season, and Batman gets dosed basically and is just having an acid trip, and he sees his parents walking into a tunnel, and then the tunnel becomes a gun barrel and it fires and a bullet comes out, and then blood starts pouring out of the barrel. And in fact, they made them change it for the second airing. They turned the blood into black and white because but the version I saw, it was blood red, and I was like,
wow,
holy shit, how is this a kid show?
We were interviewing Bruce Timm years ago, and he was talking about the Batgirl scene. And he said when they first did it, she fell, and, you know, she looked hurt and everything. And they were like, let's not do that. Let's just have the rope hang in the air. And I was like, that's so much more terrifying to a kid. Yeah.
Because the rope hangs in the air, and she crashes onto the hood of her dad's car 80 floors below. Like, first of all, she would have killed everyone in that car, but when that show got announced, I had somehow assumed that they would have already like done a whole writer's room or whatever they did, and I just reached out to Bruce Timm and asked if I could freelance an episode, because it was like a bucket list thing. Like I gotta, if they're gonna make more BTAZ or more Bruce Timm Batman, I gotta see if I can do one. And then Bruce was like, well, how about just, you know, come on and be like the showrunner, head writer? And I was like,
All right. Good email. Like, nice email. You know,
yeah, I did it, but it was super fun, actually. Like, I brought my best friend, is this writer, Hallie Gross, that I met on Westworld, and she co-wrote the second Last of Us game, and so I brought her on to work on it, and we worked on a TV show with Nicholas Refn together before. But I couldn't get her for Criminal because she's working on the Last of Us TV show now. Mm. But she did. Everybody in the writer's room were like two episodes, and then we freelanced a couple, and I got Mark Bernardin to write one and Greg Rucka to write the other one. Greg Rucka actually wrote episode two, which is like the first Rene Montoya episode.
That's awesome.
It's a lot different than, I'll warn you guys, it's a lot different than BTAZ. It's very much a reconception of, you know, just sort of starting over, like doing it's PG. Like when we first started, we were told we could do PG-13, which, you know, I was like, oh my God, is someone going to say shit in a Batman cartoon? But no, it's not PG-13. but it's definitely, it's a lot different. It's like, it's sort of like the show Bruce Timm always wanted to make, but that they wouldn't let him make. So like, there's a lot more like, you know, people actually getting punched on camera and like, you know, I don't want to spoil it for you guys, but it's like, Everyone will kill me if I say it, but it's kind of noir. It's definitely a different take that I hope people will love, but I think people will also be shocked by some things.
So you're saying the gun blood is red, is what we can say.
I mean, Batman's just murdering people left now.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Oh, that makes me feel good. Couple of quick things to ask you about before we let you go. Just sort of status of these things from a while ago. Killer Be Killed. We haven't heard about that media-wise in a while.
Yeah, that didn't work out. With that production company for the film. And so those rights all came back to us on that. And, you know, hopefully we'll try and figure out a way to maybe turn that into a TV show or a movie. You know, I've got this deal at Amazon to adapt more stuff. So we'll see. But that's definitely one I think could become something.
Velvet, same sort of thing.
That one... yeah, just the rights got tied up for a long time, and now we're just sort of trying to figure out what to do with it. But there's been a lot of interest in it over the years.
Maniac Cop. I know that's one that seems to be dead, it's back, it's dead, it's back.
Yeah, I have no idea, honestly. I haven't talked to Ref in about a year. Like, it got greenlit at HBO at one point. I had written a movie version of it, and then I worked with Refn and this other friend of ours to sort of figure out a way to take some of the movie script and then sort of do a rewrite on and sort of turn it into the pilot episode of an 8-episode thing instead. And so I did that just sort of on spec for him while we were working on the TV show. So it'd be great if something happened with that. But then, like, I feel like it got announced, and then like a month later, basically, like, everyone in the world was like, hey, maybe not everything that's like about cops. So, like, I have a hard time seeing a world where Max especially makes a show called Maniac Cop.
Yeah.
But we were leaning in very hard to the, to like the expectations of what that would be and like the tension of the moment. Like the opening scene is the opening like 5 pages of that pilot version are fucking terrifying and also hilarious. It's like kind of like a black comedy, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't think anything will ever happen with it if I'm being really honest, but we'll see. It's Refn, so you never know.
Yeah,
right. And I mean, I can always figure out a way to get somebody to give him money to make a thing.
I mean, on that note, last thing I'll ask you about: when are we going to see Too Old to Die?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that will happen. I did. We did talk at one point about doing like a movie sequel with the Yuritsa character because we loved her, and we started talking about some ideas for that. But yeah, I don't think. Given the fact that people seemed to really be horrified by that show when it came out for a variety of reasons. It's like the weirdest fucking streaming show that ever got made. I think at least it's in like the top three, like weirdest streaming shows. That's also just like, it's like 9 art films kind of, in a way. Like it's so hard to describe to people. When I tell people to watch it, because Nick intended for you to be able to watch it in any order, so when I tell people to watch it, I always am like, if you want to see like exactly what I wrote, watch the first 20 minutes of episode 6, because it's all in Spanish, and so Nick couldn't get really tired of what they were saying because he didn't know what they were saying. So he just shot exactly what was in the script. But like, he's such a like artist on set. Like, he never just does what's in the script. He always is like, by the time he's on set getting ready to shoot it, he's read it 150 times and is like, you know what, this scene is boring.
He's sick of it. Like, exactly. Yeah, he's read it
150 times. Like, but you know, he always tries to come up with something that is like, okay, well, what's different here? What's surprising? What's jarring? What's going to really shake people? And, you know, I really love that about him, that he's like, just obstinately an artist. Like, he was so thrilled that Drive got sued for not being Fast and the Furious. Like, that was an actual lawsuit that someone was like, this trailer made it seem like it would be, there would be car chases. But yeah, I love that guy. He's a total lunatic.
Yeah, it's captivating. And the fact that he can still get that cash to make stuff, amazing.
He's Drive is one of the best crime films that ever got made, you know, and I love most of his stuff, really. But yeah, there's a character in Night Fever. The Rainer character is sort of my sort of crazed homage to him, that I wanted to sort of have a crazed European dragging a guy into terrible situations over and over again. I was like, that feeling with Refn of like,
yeah, you're the
what
guy
are you getting me into now?
Before we let you go, just to get back to comics, obviously this book, like we talked about, it's coming out next week and then a month later in bookstores. But are you and Sean already on to the next thing? Are you working on
one? Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll be done probably end of January with our next book, which is it's kind of like a crime thriller, but also sort of about the Satanic Panic. So timely.
I was going to say, that's where we're at.
It's called, it's called Houses of the Unholy. And I don't know how to share my screen, or I could show you the cover, but it'll be out. It'll be announced soon. Probably. I guess announced it on your podcast.
There you go.
But yeah, that should be out next summer. So it's like, we're still on like summer and Christmas. Like my goal now is that we always get a book out in early December. So one of our books can always be someone's Christmas present that they
that's awesome. Give.
Cause you know, like, we actually, one of the things that we started doing I think the first time was maybe Junkies or Pulp. We do like these signed book plates for stores that order like a certain amount of copies on initial orders can like get these signed book plates from us. And for the new book, we actually apparently underestimated demand. So we're having to do a bunch more. So I was like, oh, well, I guess that's good. I realized like, oh, we're putting this thing out in comic book stores like right at Christmas shopping season, and you know, it's got a big white and red cover.
Great gift.
And are you still able to work with Jacob Phillips, given he's now very in demand? We love that Texas Blood, and all the other stuff he's doing.
Gang.
I don't think Jake is allowed to quit, so he'll just have to fit us in. Like, I mean, it's his dad. What's he gonna do?
Right? Like, can't go against that.
My biggest fear is that Jake will get too busy. Us switching to graphic novels was actually good for him, because then he only has to stop like you know, twice a year. He just spends like, you know, 3 or 4 weeks coloring a book, and you know, and then drawing some of his own stuff on the side at the same time. But you know, I really feel like he's probably the most unique colorist in comics, and definitely one of the best, but no one colors like him. Like, I just love how he looked at what Betty did and what Dave did on our stuff, and then he just kind of took the parts of that worked, and then added this crazed punk art school, you know, Manchester vibe to everything. I just love it. Like, when I look at other books now, I'm just like, everyone's coloring in the lines. What's wrong with them?
Yeah, grow up crazy like us.
It's awesome, Ed. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for chatting again. Love the book.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, no, this was a lot of fun, guys. Great podcast. Right,
we'll see you next summer, and then next December, and then next summer, and then next summer.
until we die.
Yeah.
until one of us can't keep up.
Yeah. Thanks, Ed. Have a great night.
See you later, Ed.
Bye.
All right, there we go. Ed Brubaker. You can check out Where the Body Was December 13th in comic book stores, and then January 16th. In non-comic bookstores, just regular bookstores.
Also known as bookstores, yeah.
I guess so. Legit bookstores is what I wanted to say, but I feel like that unlegitimizes the comic bookstores is the problem.
That's good. All stores should have books in them.
I agree. And folks, we're going to move on with our next section, which is my second favorite section after this interview we just had. It's time for your audience questions.
Yeah.
Comments over on YouTube or Twitter, not Twitter/X, because they don't do that. Oh, you can't hear me?
Couldn't for a while, but now you're sounding
cold. Oh, sweet. Well, I'm going to turn this music off because that was probably the problem. But have you moved on? I'm still nursing my whipped cream. I thought this was going to melt into the bourbon. It's still going hard.
Staying strong. You really hard whipped that. I finished mine very good. And I moved on to a Pils Mafia. Shouts to the Buffalo Bills and their mafia of pills.
Nice. Pouring a little more and that whipped cream floated right to the top. This drink is very good, by the way.
Very good.
I just wanted to re-emphasize it. Bourbon, I use the Lugiardo Maraschino. The cream.
It's a real, like lay down and go to bed.
I felt myself falling asleep a little bit during that interview, but I didn't because it was so fascinating.
Oh, nice. Way to find the compliment in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I came around to it. Let's get to some questions here. We have at least one from Pablo. Has anyone seen the trailer for GTA 6? Great trailer.
Nice. I haven't, but I actually read a little bit about it, and just the unbelievable amount of people that have already watched the trailer that have bought the previous game. So this is what we should all be working on.
Were you a GTA guy? Were you a Grand Theft Auto guy at all?
I've always been a Nintendo guy, so yeah. I'm exclusively playing. I'm deep into Super Mario Wonder, really enjoying that. That I'm playing now with and sort of competing with my 7-year-old daughter, who is actually pretty surprisingly, she's caught up to me in the game.
Okay.
Worrisome in a worrisome way, where I'm like, she's like the Fred Savage and Wizard.
I've gotten old.
Yeah.
I was a GTA guy for a while, very into the games. I definitely liked Vice City a lot, but San Andreas was the one that I was obsessed with. That just had that amazing, like 90s hip hop soundtrack that was playing on the radios the entire time. Awesome. Spent so many hours playing that game. I don't know about this one. I mean, I certainly don't have like an advanced, whatever, where they're on to PlayStation 5, PlayStation 6, something like that. That is not my thing. I'm also more of a Nintendo guy. But it looks good. I do think it's a weird, I feel like the world has moved on from Grand Theft Auto, kind of. Like, I don't know if it's the right time to be releasing a game where it's people blowing up cars and shooting each other in the face and stuff like that. But I don't know, could be wrong. I guess we'll see what happens.
Nice.
This is from Kevin. What is your favorite media-induced childhood trauma, and have you made your kids watch it yet?
Great question. No, sort of avoiding the traumatic stuff for now. I think one of them was definitely almost all of Nothing But Trouble, the comedy. God.
That movie is a nightmare.
That movie is a nightmare, and it actually did traumatize me. We saw, sort of in that same vein, we saw The Burbs in the theater, and that was scary at points, definitely. Mm-hmm. I was too young to be seeing that when I saw it.
Most of the stuff that, I don't know if it traumatized me as a kid, but definitely scared me as a kid. My kids, when we watch it, are like, they turn to me in the most derogatory way and say, "You were scared of that?" Just because.
Wow. That's badass. It's also adding shame to your 100%.
Like in Ghostbusters, I warned them. I said, "Hey, just so you know, the library ghost is pretty scary." And she came out and you're like, "You were scared of that, Dad? What are you talking about?" And I was like, "Okay, it was a different time. It was a different time. We thought ghosts existed at that point, and this looked real to me. It was like a documentary." The other one.
Dad, I thought you always said that you ain't afraid of no ghosts, but you're afraid of that ghost.
I was, in fact. The other one recently, I feel like I mentioned this on a Week Geek podcast, but when I was a kid and Gremlins was coming out, my friends.
All you talk about is Gremlins, dude. You love Gremlins.
I love Gremlins. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. Told me about the scene in the kitchen where the Gremlin gets blended up and the other one explodes in the microwave. And they're like, "Oh, it's so gross. It's so scary." So when I went to see Gremlins with my parents, I told my mom beforehand, I said, I don't want to see this. You got to take me out of the theater when that happens. And I have such a distinct memory. I know where the movie theater is, and it's still there in Queens. We went in Queens for some reason. And I remember my mom took me out of the lobby. We stood there just at the lobby silently for like 5 minutes. And then she looked at me and she's like, okay, they're not in the kitchen anymore. And then we went back and watched the rest of the movie. And when we watched Gremlins, I told my kids this. I was like, hey, it wasn't that I was scared about this. It was that my friends told me it was scary, so I didn't see it. And they still did the exact same thing when they came on the scene. They're like, this isn't scary. What are you? Why were you scared? And I was like, I said, I wasn't scared. How dare you?
Now, are they be able to hear you when they're dipping your head into the toilet, your children, in between the swirlies?
I mean, I don't know, because my underwear is over my head at that point because they've wedged me.
It's atomic. That's atomic.
Stray Bullet says, Brubaker mentioned things you may regret, like drinking too much. I've never regretted drinking too much. Have either of you regretted drinking too much, and why?
I get this question a lot, and I don't ever regret it galactically. I definitely regret it when in the morning, I guess, a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I definitely haven't had wine coolers since slope day at Cornell on freshman year. That was last day of class when everybody got drunk on a slope. Haven't had wine cooler since. So
that's nice. The first time I ever got drunk, I drank like 15 shots of vodka at my friend's college and barfed in a pillowcase while his mom was driving us back to my hometown.
Yeah.
That was a regret.
Oh, that's another time that I regret it is when we got the show with
that was fantastic.
We got the show with Nerdist that was being produced by Broadway Video, and the producer took us out drinking. It was great. Like, we had a fabulous time, but we've told the story a million times, but every single time he was like, should we get more shots? And I was like, because I was so drunk by that point.
We went down the line and I was like, yes. And I think Pete maybe had left at that point. And then I pointed to you and you were like,
And I legitimately, and I regret this to this day, got one block away from home and threw up all over a cab. And I felt so bad. Lost my phone. The next morning, my daughter at that point was, I don't know, I want to say one, maybe not even.
Yeah.
Something like that. And I was the primary caregiver.
And she was like, would you barf, you wuss?
No, I called my parents and I was like, I'm so sick. Please come take care of her. And they're like, oh, I'm so sorry. Do you have a fever? And I was like, yep, that's what's going on. Fever. Yeah. Really it bad fever.
Like a brewery in here.
This is from Omniassault RH Show. Justin, did you ever play Animal Crossing New Horizons? And if so, can we visit your island?
I never played that. I feel shame that I haven't, because that would be a fun place to hang out.
Mm-hmm.
But I never could
get. I can't get into those type of games where it's just like mobile games like that. I'll play them for 2 weeks and then delete the game. But to buy a game where it's just hanging out on an island, I can't do that. I need.
I mean, let me be honest. I have both Zelda games for the Switch, and because they're such like wander hangs, mm-hmm. I haven't gotten into them yet.
Yeah, it is funny. I was telling my son earlier, because he was asking me about Grand Theft Auto, actually, where I was like, oh, actually, that was kind of a hang game for me, where I didn't really bother with the missions. I just drive around and run people over and have a good time. This is from Stanley. Any fun holiday plans this year?
Going into the holidays this month, I'm doing a live show in New York and LA based on the travel show that I did, 101 Place to Party Before You Die. On the 12th, December 12th here in New York and Brooklyn, we're doing a live show, and then in LA on the 16th. So that will be a fun
That's awesome.
Couple plans. Yeah.
I am excited you guys are doing that. This is from Nelson Kelso. Oh, I didn't say my holiday plans. No, I don't have any holiday plans. Nelson Kelso, this question, I got to be honest, feels like harassment. Alex, did you ever get back to the Scott Pilgrim game? No, I haven't gotten past the second level yet. Okay.
Have you tried? Are you struggling?
No, I haven't tried. I don't know what you're talking about. Justin, what was your strategy? Because it's definitely not an easy game. And who did you guys pick? I had to go out with Scott. Yes, I also did Scott. What about you?
I did Ramona for a long time. And then later I switched to Scott. But strategy-wise, you got to punch those people, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's very much like River City Ransom, if you haven't played it, a classic Nintendo game that I love. So I have a lot of experience pressing the punch and kick buttons really quickly, mm-hmm. which maybe is something, Alex, you could work on.
Not really. I'm more of an Animal Crossing guy.
Nice. You don't have to punch and kick hardly at all as you're designing your turnip area. But it did take some time. You know, I stayed up very, very late for no good reason, just playing that for many days.
Awesome. Maybe I'm taking a week off in like 2 weeks, so maybe I'll actually finish that game. We'll see what happens. As a follow-up, when does the podcast return? Scott Pilgrim versus the podcast. We've got two episodes of Takes Off to finish. People have been traveling. We've been off for weekends and stuff, but we're 100% going to finish it. That is not...
Yes, very soon. This week, I think we'll definitely get at least one done. And let me... Because I'm doing them one by one, I haven't watched the finale.
Oh, my God.
So okay. I'm dying to record this.
All right, we'll do it. We'll definitely catch up. We're also going to do the video game. Maybe we'll figure out some other stuff to do. I've been having fun talking about it. This is from Nat Townsend. If you could turn any Ed Brubaker comic into a GTA game, which book and who would voice the main character?
Wow.
I don't know. I mean, this is a little bit of a cheat, but he did Gotham Central, right? Like,
yeah, wow, that is definitely a cheat.
Yes.
So you're just saying have it be GTA?
Yeah, I mean, GTA in Gotham, that would be awesome. I will say, I mean, this is the opposite thing, but while we're talking about video games, they just put up the Arkham Asylum trilogy on Switch for $60 for all three games. And I'm like, I still got to finish the Scott Pilgrim game, but I really want to do that. I played the second game back in the day, and it's so good.
That's fun. I have not played any of those for real. So that'd be fun. What about a game for Fatal? I think that's a good, like a classic. That could be fun.
Yeah, or Kill or Be Killed. I know we were talking about that earlier. That's a little more superhero-y, but that would be super fun.
Easy or the Reader Fade says, Out, a Hollywood writer. Let's do the Fade Out.
Oh, yeah. Easy Reader says, hi, guys. Are King Kong and Godzilla going to be a permanent part of the DC universe? No. The Justice League versus Godzilla and Kong story is an out-of-continuity story. They've said that up front. So there you go. Stray Bullet has a really inappropriate question. Didn't you also throw someone in traffic, Alex? Look, that was just one booth man one time. Frederica Rosa says, what did you guys think about What If Season 2 coming out daily? So this is coming out December 22nd through December 30th, 9 episodes over 9 days. Weird strategy, I think. Like, I understand the thought process there, but I feel like What If is the wrong series to do it with.
Well, and what is the strategy, though, to like keep it, try to own the holiday conversation and make it a thing? Like the, what was that murder show that was on years ago that actually dominated catching a killer or something? The one in Wisconsin. Either way, it did do that. But I agree with you. I don't know if What If can do that. And I don't know if like, is that really going to keep people on the service, which is sort of the point of all this? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. The problem is the animated stuff. I love animation, but animated stuff doesn't get nearly the viewers that live action stuff does. If they did 9 episodes of Loki over 9 days, that would be an event. They'd also be tossing it out very quickly, frankly. But 9 episodes of What If is, if you're going to watch it, What If, you will watch What If. That's pretty much it.
But also, like, What If such a specific premise concept? Like, I want space. I want to be able to, like, digest it. Unless they're tying it together much more this season, which I hope they aren't doing. I actually didn't like that.
Yeah.
It should be standalone.
I feel like, maybe I'm making this up, but I feel like Iman Vellani said that Miss Marvel is a central character in What If Season 2. Sounds like there's some sort of overall plot thing going on there. Don't like it. Yeah. Whatever. We'll cover it on our podcast. We got one last one here. Have you guys seen the Suicide Squad anime trailer? I'm excited for that. I have not.
I have also not, but that sounds dope.
Yeah. There we go. All right, folks. Unfortunately, we do not have trivia because Pete is not
That's
here.
Pete's thing. That's also, we've talked so long with Ed, so, you know.
We did. So we got to wrap up here. Before we do, though, new comic books are coming out. Justin, what are you excited for that is coming out this week?
Oh, great question. There's so much to talk about. Alex, what do you say?
Yeah, I'll throw out a couple while you're looking through the list. I have been pretty psyched to check out Batman Santa Claus Silent Night is coming out. This is actually in canon story of Santa Claus as one of Batman's old mentors. And I, conversely to what we were saying with What If, I think this is a great experiment for comic books. DC is releasing one issue a week for 4 weeks over December, which feels like
that tracks.
Yeah, what a great Christmas themed fun book with a ridiculous premise. It's written by Jeff Parker, who is great. So excited for that. And two Marvel books I'm very intrigued by. Thunderbolts number one, which is from Lansing and Kelly, picking up on their great Captain America run. So interested to see that. And also the Sentry number one is coming out. Sentry books are always very interesting and delve into mental health.
Yeah,
I feel like this one is probably not going to do that. I'm curious to see if they do give some sort of twist in some way. I've enjoyed pretty much every Sentry mini series or series that they've done. So fascinated to see what happens here. Justin?
I got to shout out Sacrificers number 5, the Remender book, which has been sort of slow building a big world and a mythology, obviously dark takes around this world where someone from different families in different villages have to go to the capital and be sacrificed for the greater good. And there's just a lot of details coming out in each issue. Really enjoying that. And Birds of Prey number 4, I think, has been just by Kelly Thompson. Loving that. Beautiful art by Leonardo Romero. And one other one I was going to say, and that one is Transformers number 3 by Daniel Warren Johnson. I can't believe how emotional these
are. Oh, my God.
You're really just, they're a bunch of cars fighting, and you love them. You love them to fucking death.
Yeah. All right. That is it for this week's show. A couple of people, thank you. And if I said, Drew Baker, if you're coming on the show again, check out Where the Body Was. December 13th in comic book stores, January 16th in bookstores. Next week on the show, we got a packed one. Austin McKinley is going to be here to talk about Riot Force, Taz Mokonek to talk about Lost Time, and Joe Nicklow to talk about Surviving Comics. Don't forget to check out, as we mentioned, Sir Scott Pilgrim vs. the Podcast, Comic Book Club News, our daily news show, Patreon.com/comicbookclub to support the show and all the shows we do. You can subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, or the app of your choice. Wherever you're listening, honestly, I don't care. At Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on Instagram and TikTok, comicbookclublive.com. For this podcast and many more, until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Good night, everybody.